Hello, my name is Victoria Glasson and I'm the editor of Diabetes Therapy. Welcome to our Technology in Diabetes podcast. Today we will be talking with Dr. Sufyan Hussain, Consultant Physician in Diabetes and Endocrinology and an Honorary Senior Lecturer at Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust and King's College London. And he'll be speaking with Dana Lewis, Founder and Developer of OpenAPS.
Hello, Diabetes Therapy. I am Sufyan Hussain. I'm a diabetes and endocrine physician and honorary senior clinical lecturer in one of the UK's leading type 1 diabetes teams. I've lived with type 1 for nearly 30 years and actually really excited by anything to do with it. With the team at Diabetes Therapy, we'll be taking you through some exciting aspects of type 1 diabetes and diabetes technology with some very special guests. I look forward to learning more and be really interested in your comments on hashtag T1D podcast. It's the 27th of November, 2019. Today, I'm joined by the wonderful Dana Lewis. Dana is joining us from Seattle. She's a co-creator of the Do-It-Yourself Artificial Pancreas System. She's also the author of the ebook, Automated Insulin Delivery, How Artificial Pancreas Closed-Loop Systems Can Aid You Living with Diabetes, the only book around for artificial pancreas systems. Today's session will be focusing on the journey of how DIY APS came about, where we're at, and the next steps for all involved in the type 1 community. Before I get Dana to speak, I'll just tell you about my interactions with Dana before this. I've met Dana once in person in London, 2016, and we've spoken via Skype and worked on a few things. The one thing I always remember about Dana is a super positive, energizing buzz, an attitude of helping others, what she calls paying it forward. On that note, Dana, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Great. No, it's really super exciting for us to have you and learn about the DIY APS movement. But before you do that, just tell us a bit about yourself.
I was actually diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 14. So I've now lived with it for many years and have seen the evolution of technology from finger sticks and multiple daily injections to using an insulin pump, using a CGM, and now using what we call closed loop therapy. But I am American. I live in the United States. I come from a communications background, but I've spent more and more of my time in the last couple of years researching and working on the side in the diabetes space.
So DIY, how did you start this?
So DIY stands for do it yourself, which is actually what diabetes is. Diabetes is so self-managed by people with diabetes. We do 99% of everything on our own. So when people ask me about DIY, they're usually asking about DIY diabetes technology. And my journey in that space started when I was frustrated with not being able to hear my continuous glucose monitor alarm and wanted to find a way to make a louder alarm and was not satisfied with the response from the companies saying that I was the only one with this problem or it would be out in a couple of years in the next version. And so I actually was able to spot a solution that somebody else created. John Kostick created a way to remotely monitor his son's CGM data and asked him to share his code. He said yes, and that enabled me to take my CGM data, put it in the cloud, make a louder alarm, and send it down to my phone. And from there, we added an algorithm to do decision-making into the future in kind of an open-loop system, although we didn't know it at the time. And then by talking with others and sharing what we had done, we met somebody else named Ben West who had figured out how to remotely communicate with some of the older insulin pumps. And a few weeks after that, we realized, oh, we have the ability to talk to the pump. We have the ability to talk to the CGM. We've built an algorithm that decides what needs to be done. We can close the loop and actually automate adjusting the insulin delivery. So that's what we did.
Wow. That sounds really, really exciting. And you know, just talk us through the steps. I mean, how was the reaction of your reaction and reaction of others as you started working on these?
So my reaction was a lot of, oh, wow, I feel really empowered to solve my own problems. You know, maybe not everybody else has this problem, but it's definitely something affecting my quality of life and I want to change. And so I want to do it for me and it's worth sharing because if it helps one other person sleep safely and confidently through the night, it's absolutely worth it. And so my reaction is one of empowerment and positivity and joy because this is really, really helping me. And other people's reaction ranges from skepticism to also positivity of them wanting to explore also doing their own DIY solution and seeing if it works for them.
So really exciting stuff. And as you know, rightly say that diabetes has always been about DIY and doing things, applying things to your own personal self and learning and empowering yourself with the knowledge that's out there. But this obviously is such a huge step forward in how the creative capital of people have come together and worked to make the lives of each other much better and much by crowd sharing, open source, collaborative approaches. So really a unique example. So how did it all spread? I mean, obviously it's gone from working with a few people to now going almost viral to a lot of people being aware of it worldwide and certainly the community growing.
Well, I think you said it exactly right. It's a story of people coming together. And I think it's really easy when you tell the story of a technology to latch on to one person's story. And because I've been public about my story is one of the ones often told. But this is the story of a community project. I was helped by John. I was helped by Ben. We collaborated as a community to build the solution and continue to work on it over years. There's dozens, if not hundreds of people who have played a role. And I think it's really neat because it's not that this type of technology wasn't known to industry or wasn't known to researchers, but we were in the right place at the right time where social media enabled us to share what we were doing, share our ideas, come together and problem solve. And the diabetes technology was also there. We're using existing commercially approved pumps and CGM with off-the-shelf hardware to bridge the communications between these devices. So I just think it's really, really cool because the community came together to solve problems. And then people also learn about this through their own local communities or from online communities. And that's really, really how it spread, both in the diabetes community, but also word of mouth through healthcare providers as well.
Wow. So would you like to know what my initial reactions were when I first came across the movement?
Yeah, I'd love to hear what your perspective was when you found out back in, 2015 or 2016?
Actually, it was before that. I'd heard about it from people online, people in my clinic. And my initial thoughts were, sounds too good to be true. Is this a cult? It seems a bit techie. Nah, not for me. I like my minimalist lifestyle, set my routines. And I think, as I got learned more and more into it, and I think it was really your talk in 2016, that got me thinking very differently, because until then I was working in something called co-production, which was valuing our citizens, co-working with people and lay members to improve healthcare. And there were lots of talk about harnessing technology to improve health outcomes through this sort of crowd sharing and open source collaborative approaches. And these were coming from think tanks like Nesta and King's Fund in the United Kingdom about how this would be a solution for healthcare in the years to come. And a lot of this seemed talk at that time, and I thought, great, stuff from the ivory tower. But when I actually heard your talk, I thought, wow, this is amazing how people have come together and made something so clever and got well ahead of where the technology sector is and where academia has been. And yes, learned from the ideas that came out, but obviously applied it and used it. And I think as I've learned more about it and got to know more from people using it and gained a lot more insight, I've just been, as I say, just really, really taken aback by the level of sophistication, the ease of use, how intuitive it is, how many layers of safety have been put in, the actual intricacies of the code. So yeah, just very, very, very almost surprised when I first started to get to know it really well, almost about a year ago. And at that time, I thought to myself, well, I've got a PhD, I've got 15 years of being a doctor, almost 30 years, of being type 1 and used pumps and sensors. I've kind of seen it all. But really, after learning and seeing how the artificial pancreas systems work, how it adjusts things, it's given me a very different insight into how to even manage people with type 1 diabetes in complex situations. So yeah, so for me, it's been a fascinating insight and learning from the community project, which has been really just something, I think, a great model for healthcare, not just type 1 diabetes, but a great model for healthcare to embody.
Yeah, well, I think it really just shows how hard diabetes is and how much we don't know about it, because for a lot of people, quality of life is so so low and so challenging, even if you're lucky enough to have access to insulin and have access to tools like pumps and CGMs, we're still tasking human brains with doing the work of a highly evolved organ, the pancreas, and that brain is also being tasked with, you know, other things, and it's hard. So I think one of the really interesting things that people don't realize is we made small changes over time. We tackled each problem as we found it, or each thing that we wanted to improve, and we tweaked and we tried, and in some cases we failed and we tried again to solve the problem. And by making those small changes in the direction, those changes became multiplicative instead of additive, right? And it made a huge difference with just being able to solve one thing at a time. It's like the phrase some people say, like, how do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat it one bite at a time. And I think when we look at diabetes, it's very, very easy as healthcare providers or as patients to feel overwhelmed because there are so many variables that come into play with adjusting blood sugars and impacting blood sugars. But once you have this type of technology, it automates away a lot of the work, and it brings such better glycemic results that you can then spot new problem areas that you didn't think were solvable before. And that's one of my favorite parts about where this technology is heading. It's not just that we automated insulin delivery. Like, that in of itself is amazing and awesome. It's not just about the fact that we were able to do this, you know, before commercial technology came out. But one of the things I'm most excited about is that we've not stopped learning, both in the process of technology development, but we also haven't stopped learning about diabetes. We're still discovering new things because we've automated and reduced so much of the noise. We're finding out new things about the way diabetes works in people with type 1 diabetes. And I think that's really, really cool and kind of unexpected that patients would be able to be the ones to reduce the noise and identify where some of these problem areas are.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think the example you highlight in your book, the illustration you've shown about manual diabetes to automated diabetes, I think sums it up so nicely. And it's something that I use a lot and use a lot when I'm explaining type 1 diabetes to people who don't understand the intricacies behind it. Exactly as you say, it's 24/7, it's constant, it requires a lot of thinking, a lot of planning, a lot of insight, a lot of foresight, a lot of knowledge about how to adjust things. And then if you try to live your life, whether you're a carer for kids or whether you're in a full-time job doing shift work, where you're doing all of those together and then driving and then trying to do some activities that may or may not be planned, you can just imagine how much variation could occur from within your diabetes. And what this gives you is that flexibility and automation to allow you to do more, and gives you the capacity to do it without having to think about it all the time.
Exactly. And there are probably a dozen or more reasons why somebody would choose automated insulin delivery. It's not going to be for everyone, because not everybody wants to wear a pump and CGM, and that's totally fine. But some people will say, okay, well, I'm willing to wear a pump and a CGM already, but, you know, I'm getting my target A1C, so what's the benefit for me? And especially if you look online in the patient communities, you just see story after story of somebody saying, yeah, I was getting my target A1C, but I was doing so much work. My loved ones were doing so much work. It took so much time and energy and effort to achieve that result. And so I'm getting the same result, but, you know, less work to achieve it. And that quality of life benefit alone is super, super high. But that's also probably a small portion of the people who are choosing to use automated insulin delivery. There are many people who, despite their best efforts, aren't able to achieve, you know, the A1C and the levels of glycemic variability that they want. And so this system can make a big, big difference in helping people achieve those results. And the ripple effect on everything from having more time spent in range to sleeping better, feeling better, having more energy, you know, and just being able to live your life more fully, it's just incredible.
Absolutely. And we see this in the US type 1 registry data as well, that despite the increasing use of technology, it doesn't always mean it does improve quality of life. It will hopefully reduce hypos. It will hopefully improve your flexibility, but it doesn't always mean that you end up getting the sort of glycemia that you'd aspire to get. And I think that's where, you know, your point really comes in, that trying to navigate and use those alongside the complexity of life. And life has become a lot more challenging over the years. You know, you've got a lot more burdens coming from different directions. And that's really where automation comes in.
Yeah, and I think one thing is we often assume that we will add technology on and expect the human to do the same things. For example, carb counting and meal announcing, as well as bolusing or injecting for meal times. However, through the automation and the advancements in this technology, we're now at the point, at least in the DIY community, where some of us have the choice whether or not to carb count, whether or not to announce a meal, whether or not we should bolus fully or partially for a meal. And that suddenly changes the landscape of diabetes and the way we do healthcare, because instead of people being shamed and blamed for so many behaviors they're being tasked to do, excluding the ones around mealtime, being able to say, okay, we can quantify the impact of you choosing to do a meal bolus or not, or choosing to enter meals or not with a particular type of closed loop system. And so you can look at the time and range difference and the A1C difference from those patterns of behavior and decide, is it worth it? And for a lot of people, that's going to be a game changer in their relationship with their diabetes and their relationship with the healthcare provider, where instead of feeling dread of going into the healthcare provider and feeling like they're always being told that they're doing something wrong, it can be a more productive conversation about what are the trade-offs between particular behaviors and the glycemic benefits or the benefits to quality of life by choosing to do or not do particular behaviors that we used to think were absolutely non-negotiable. And I'm really excited about that being the future of diabetes care and being able to quantify that, because I think that provides a lot more freedom and flexibility beyond what I think kind of most of the diabetes world think is possible right now.
And so, you know, one of the things that I just thought I'd pick up on is the terminology around artificial pancreas systems, because obviously artificial pancreas systems is a great catchword. Being a kind of having a scientific background myself, the pancreas is quite a clever little organ that does lots of little different things. And one of the terminology that's used a lot in the literature now is hybrid closed loops, and another one is automated insulin dosing systems. And I don't know what you would prefer, how we term this particular type of system as things evolve for the future.
I think it's hard, and that's also why you see that I named my book very carefully, because some people prefer artificial pancreas. Others say, no, it's not fully replacing the pancreas. It's a closed-loop system. But then people don't recognize what the difference is between hybrid and fully closed-loop. And some people think a fully closed-loop is only a fully closed-loop if it's multiple drugs versus single hormone. So I think it's kind of complicated. I think there's a lot of different names, but it's good to be clear with the terminology we're using. And it's also hard because there's different DIY systems, for example, and there's different commercial systems, and they're not all hybrid closed loops. Some of the systems have full closed loop capabilities if the users choose to use them that way. And that's eventually where the technology is heading. But I think one of the challenges is that most of the general public doesn't realize that insulin pumps aren't already closed loops. Many people think insulin pumps already adjust for changing glucose levels, which standard insulin pumps don't. And so I think even within the diabetes community, there's confusion. Within the general public, there's confusion. So it's good to be upfront about the technology we're talking about and the interaction that the human has to do with the system, which is more, for example, if you have a hybrid closed loop versus a fully closed loop.
Yes, that's very true. That, you know, I think common misconceptions around even what pumps or, you know, do pumps measure sugars is something that the general public sometimes do ask us about. And I think so, yeah, lots of misconceptions. And you're right, terminology is important. I mean, from my perspective as a healthcare professional, I like the people using the system to understand that it is an automated insulin dosing system. So they understand that it's an automated code, which is going to be reliant on the glucose data to then give insulin in a coded manner, which will be reliant on certain assumptions and will also require some level of manual input, depending on, you know, as you rightly say, how closed loop it is, how closed it is. So that's what I try and get them to think about, because then at least get them thinking that it's not going to be a quick fix. I'm going to apply this on, get it working, and it will solve everything. But it's something that I will have to use and learn and understand how it works to adapt into my life. And yes, it will make my life easier, but there are certain things that I will need to learn before I get onto it, and certain things I'll need to learn as I use it. So I don't know what your thoughts are, Dana. Do you think that's the right way of thinking as a clinician?
Yeah, I think for patients and clinicians, it's important to understand that there's a learning curve with any new type of technology. And I often tell people it's like switching from multiple daily injections to an insulin pump. There's a learning curve there, and you have to adjust your settings and you have to change the way you work with that different type of technology. And switching from manual to automated insulin delivery, where the system is automated, you're also going to have to change your behaviors. You will change how you interact with it, and it is automated, but like you said, it's not a cure. And so once you get it up and running and you get over that initial learning curve, you shift your focus from having to really think ahead and do all the work yourself to, with regards to managing the blood sugars, to keeping the system operating with things like making sure your insulin pump site is in your body and that the insulin is absorbing, and things like keeping your CGM sensor on your body. And the tips that I often give to people when they're thinking about shifting to automated insulin delivery or they're just getting started is to remind them to plan ahead so that when your sensor session dies, ideally it's not going to be in the middle of the night, or ideally it's not going to be right at the start or the middle when you have a big meal digesting. And those little things and those shifts in what you think about and what you're maintaining, it makes a big difference. But it's important for people to figure out how they operate with this new technology, and they don't go in assuming, okay, I'm going to do all the same things I did before, or I'm going to quit doing everything because the system will do everything. Well, it can't do everything. It's not a cure. So you have to maintain the site, the sensor, and keep the system running. So it's a different type of work and a different type of thinking. And so I think making sure you have the expectations of what that learning curve looks like, both for patients and providers, is really important.
Great. So I'm pleased on the right lines. But as you rightly say, once you get the system in place and you get it working, it makes that manual process a lot more automated and hopefully less challenging. So just to, you know, obviously this is great stuff with how it's helping people with type 1 diabetes, but what have been the challenges, would you say, and the barriers in terms of seeing this type of technology being used and seeing the spread of it?
I think it depends on whether we're talking about the technology as a general concept or if we're talking specifically about DIY. I think there's some challenges that are specific to DIY in terms of you have to do it yourself. You are in charge of it. If it breaks, you must fix it and things like that. But I think in general, getting healthcare providers to understand automated insulin delivery is going to take a while. I think patients are very, very excited for this technology, but I think healthcare providers will also have to change the way they work and how they interact with patients who are using this technology. And I think the change in education and the change in approach to healthcare that will shift as a result of that is going to be one of the challenges as people want to adopt this technology. So I think patients will continue to play a role in helping educate providers and bringing this technology to them. But I'm also hoping we can speed up the education that is coming from the traditional channels that healthcare providers would typically get their education from about new technology. But I think this technology is coming. It's been now 5 years since I closed the loop for myself. It's been several years since there's been at least one or two commercial options on the market coming into more countries. So it's definitely time, and we need to make sure that the education system supports healthcare providers who are going to be supporting more and more patients using this technology too.
Yes, absolutely. And as a clinician, even now with more regulated systems on the horizon, you're absolutely right that understanding how we approach automated insulin dosing systems, or whether you call it artificial pancreas systems, how do we use it, how do we implement it, is going to be the next big step. And I think, you know, for those of us who have been involved in supporting individuals with the DIY APS systems, you know, we've certainly learned a lot. And I think we will be a little bit ahead of the curve as a result of that. And for those who are listening, both people with type 1 diabetes or healthcare professionals, I think there's a number of resources, and Dana, you can help me sort of quote some of them, but clearly the one that I'd really like to bring up is your book, which I think sums up a lot of the aspects really nicely about where to start, how this works, where to go next, the research, as well as how do you use it, what sort of learning aspects are required. So I think it covers a number of elements. And if those of you haven't seen it, it's called Automated Insulin Delivery, How Artificial Pancreas Closed Loop Systems Can Aid You Living with Diabetes. And it's available for free. Is that right, Dana?
That's right. And thank you for bringing it up. It's available for free online. You can download it as a PDF. For those who want it on their Kindle or print copy, you can also order that. But the book content is open source, so it can be freely used, and it can also be adapted. So, for example, there's a chapter in there on research, and there's a chapter in there for healthcare providers. And I've had many patients from the DIY community say, I sent this link of the healthcare provider chapter to their doctors, asking them to read it to give them some background, which is great to see it being used that way. But I also think for any healthcare providers who are newer to the closed loop space, reading the whole book, it's written for people with knowledge of diabetes, but that could be patients or healthcare providers. But it's written with the hope of helping everybody really understand the broader concepts behind this technology, the learning curves that we've talked about when shifting to automated insulin delivery, and hopefully just giving people more of a comfort level so that we have the opportunity to choose or think about whether they want to use this type of technology in the future, whether it's DIY or one of the commercial systems, that they feel like they have a better understanding and they're more equipped to make their choices.
Great. Just focusing a little bit more on challenges and barriers, I think one of the challenges for us is, us as healthcare professionals, has been coming from regulation, really, and accountability. And I don't know what your thoughts are about the regulation and accountability aspect and how we support it in the clinical domain, and how do we get past this issue, which is clearly holding up a lot of healthcare professionals from openly supporting it or using it or getting more involved in it.
I think that's a great question. And I think one of the helpful framings to think about this issue and the concern is not thinking about regulation as a rubber stamp, but regulation as a process for vetting and deciding if you can trust this technology to do what it claims to do. That's really what regulation is about. In DIY, it's unregulated because it has not gone through that process, but it's completely transparent. It's openly available for anybody, patient or doctor, to look at the code, look at the documentation, learn the system, and query the system or query the developers about any concerns or issues they have. And I actually think that we should have more healthcare providers be critical in questioning the commercial systems and not just accepting a rubber stamp of approval or not, and asking the companies more questions about how the technology works on behalf of patients. Because I think as a patient, it's very, very challenging to be given a black box and say, here you go, there's two or three knobs on this black box, trust it, it'll work eventually once it learns you, but we're not going to tell you how it learns you or how you should change your behaviors over time as it learns you or not. I think commercial technology is challenging because of the lack of transparency and because they're asking you to rely solely on the regulatory approval. And that removes the learning process and the trust development from an individual and from the healthcare provider. And I think that's really, really challenging. So I'm hoping more and more healthcare providers push for transparency and more detail on how any system works, DIY or commercial. And I'm also hoping that the industry starts to provide more details about how their system works so people can best use it in their everyday life. And I think the other thing to think about for healthcare providers who might have patients bringing in this technology is patients do off-label things all the time with their devices. Mm-hmm. For example, where they wear their CGM sensors on their body. Many people wear these sensors in off-label parts of their body. And as a healthcare provider, you might say, okay, this is only regulatory approved for this spot or this spot. You know, be aware that this has not been tested there, but I see you're getting good results and reasonable accuracy in the sensor, so okay. And I think that's the same type of conversation that we should be having about this technology. If a patient comes in, they clearly understand it, they've done their due diligence, they're using it well, they're getting good results, it shouldn't be a, this is not approved, I can't talk about it, but have the conversation about how it's off-label. And say, if you don't understand it yourself, say, I can't help you with this technology, that's totally fine. But I think there's a difference between being open about concerns or open about not understanding it versus shutting it down because it's not, you know, a regulatory approved solution. And when I say shutting it down, I mean shutting down the conversation, or in some cases, you know, refusing to see or care for that patient because they're choosing to do something that you don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah, thanks, Dana. That's a really helpful insight. And I think a lot of lessons for, I think, all the industries, really, the industry, the tech industry, the healthcare in general, being understanding more about how to be more centered towards the people who are using technologies, as well as healthcare professionals. So I think lessons for all of us that hopefully will allow more things in the future to be applied with more ease as the creative capital of people comes together and engineers things and engineers solutions like these. So in terms of research side, because that's obviously also been one of the question marks that's always put forward for DOI APS systems, because I guess it doesn't have the commercial power, the commercial money to construct large RCTs. And it's obviously with ethics, it also becomes a bit more challenging to do research and trials. But has any research been done on the DOI APS systems?
So the first research was actually a self-reported study for the community, which we presented at ADA Scientific Sessions back in 2016. And the response was mixed from healthcare providers between, wow, this is really, really neat, it's great to see some data, and, well, that's self-reported data. You know, it'd be much better if you analyze the raw data. So in years following, we did a study. It actually went through a university ethics approval. We retrospectively analyzed the raw data, presented it, saw the same general trends. And the response was, again, 50% people, this is really, really great to see the data. And 50% of people said, well, it's retrospective. It would be much better if it was observational or prospective. Well, guess what has happened since? There have been observational trials. And recently at EASD, somebody presented data from a prospective trial where they put 23 patients on one of the DIY open source closed loop systems. And the data was just like the data from all the other studies. And people have said, yeah, that's great, but that's not randomized. Randomized is the ultimate, you know, gold standard of everything else. Well, guess what? There has been a randomized control trial that has been approved and funded and is commencing recruitment early next year in New Zealand. So the community has worked with researchers and done research ourselves with all these different stages. And I think that the pushback on, well, we need research in order to vet this, is a little bit of a straw man argument for, well, this is different and this is something that we're uncomfortable with, so we're just going to try to throw up barriers in some cases. And not everybody is doing that. And I think it was good because it led us to do a lot of these studies and these trials and these data analyses. But I think it's really, really telling if you compare the research outcomes, and I can cite, you know, several studies or link to a lot of the studies that have been done around the world in different populations. There's a lot of perceptions of the community that's using DIY technology of, you know, it's all very engineering tech savvy adults. Well, no, it's not. There's actually a study done by the Open Consortium called the DIY, WHY study, that's looking at who actually is using this technology and why are people using it. And there's a variety of different types of people using it from different socioeconomic backgrounds, as well as different tech levels of experience. And so I think it's really, really interesting. We're seeing more and more research show up in this space. But I would also, again, just like in terms of scrutinizing DIY technology, and I think we should scrutinize commercial technology more carefully, I think we should do the same thing with all research around closed loops and encourage more researchers and more of the industry research to look at what are the barriers to this technology? What is the ease of use? How do people learn how to understand it? How are they using it? You know, what are the ups and the downs to using it? All the questions we're asking about DIY research, again, I think should also encourage more research with the commercial technology with the hope of getting those systems to evolve and address those things the way the DIY technology has evolved to address the concerns of both the patient community and the broader community as well over time.
Really great insight, Dana. So I think it's given a lot of food for thought about how the scientific and medical community needs to reflect and look back and view what it calls research and certainly for me as a clinician, and you know, having had a very strong academic background but then moving into the clinical arena, I certainly value the real world evidence, what you see coming out in the real world scenarios, much more highly than what I sometimes see in RCTs. And that's because obviously RCTs are constructed in a manner which obviously engenders certain type of people more. And it can also may not replicate exactly what happens in your clinic environment. So I think it's, you know, great insights from what you've said and the whole story around how outcomes are also being reported. And I think the great thing is it's great that it's open, as in it's all the outcomes, all the data is openly there. and it's not hidden or tucked away. So I'm hopeful that we will see more and more exciting things come out of it soon.
Absolutely. And I would also point out that we developed the OpenAPS Data Commons to gather data anonymously for the community for research, to have more, encourage more research in diabetes, to encourage people with new ideas to do this research. So if you're interested in doing research, if you're interested in checking out the data, check out the OpenAPS Data Commons, because that's also a tool that we as the community have made available back to the research community as well.
Due to the length of the podcast, we've chosen to split the podcast into two parts. Part two will be released next week. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Rapid Plus podcast with your preferred podcast provider, or by visiting the website.